Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you for being here with us again this Sunday, Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Our guest today, Professor Lana Swartz from UVA's Department of Media Studies. Professor Swartz is an assistant professor in the department, with most of her work on money and other media technologies. Research focuses on topics like Bitcoin, mobile wallets, historical money technologies. She's been published in leading journals. She's also been featured on the Today Show, NPR's All Things Considered, and the BBC NewsHour. She's the co-editor of a book, Paid, Tales of Dongles, Checks, and Other Money Stuff, as well as her latest book, New Money, How Payment Became Social Media. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm fascinated by this topic, types of money. And when you read New Money, it came into my head of all the tales it tells that go with it. So I'm really glad to have you here to explain so much of that to me and to the listeners. So let's just jump in. I want to know about forms of payment. Some of the things that I read from you in the books talk about how payment started with beads and shells and pretty stones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that people sometimes ask me about when I tell them, you know, I'm a media studies professor, but I study money, they say, well, what do those two things have to do with each other? You know, normally when we think about media studies, you think about, you know, radio, television, film, or internet and social media. You don't really think about money. And so I often like to kind of tell people about how I got into studying money and how I think of myself as a media studies scholar looking at money. And I think that will, you know, kind of answer this question about pretty things, stones, and now as we move into data. So, you know, money is really, and I borrow this definition from Dee Hawk, who is the kind of visionary founder of Visa. So, you know, the Visa network. He's 92 now, and he is still on Twitter, and he's on Twitter and is full of wisdom, I will say. But he has defined money as information socially guaranteed to be valuable. Okay. So that means it's, you know, some amount of information that we develop systems, whether they're social systems, material systems, to decide that this is going to be something we decide is valuable, and that we develop ways to exchange that value. So we all agree, we, you know, come up with a social system to agree that, say, a stone is valuable, and that, and better yet, if we can develop a more sophisticated money system, we develop ways to decide which stones are more valuable than others. And then I give you that stone. And when I give you that stone, I transmit that value to you. Now you hold the information that we socially guarantee to be valuable. And so to me, as a media studies person, when we start thinking about information and the tangible, or as we shall see, you know, in the present, not so tangible systems of materiality that make information material and something you can transmit to another person, either by handing it to them or sending it over a cell phone, then actually what we're really talking about is media. So a lot of times when people study money, they study it in terms of its economics, right? Who has not enough money? Who has too much money? How do markets work to kind of redistribute that money? But what I have chosen to really look at as a media studies scholar is to say, all right, what about the mediation of money? The systems we've built to move it around, to store it, to transmit it? And how have those systems changed over, you know, really since the earliest stages of our human society, but more precisely in terms of what I've studied over really like the last 200 years. And what you find is that every step of the way, if we go back looking at, say, about, you know, let's focus on 200 years, every step of the way, the technologies of money have mapped very closely alongside the technologies of communication and media more broadly. So, for example, paper money, right? Cash, paper money. That really clearly is a media form. It is covered with iconography of the nation state. It emerged in the 18th and 19th century and told, at the time, a largely illiterate public a shared history about, you know, what their nation's past was. And it's kind of an officially sanctioned history that the, you know, the government and the nation would like to tell about themselves. And it also, by kind of having not just these like historical figures on it, but also kind of allegorical figures, figures of liberty represented as a woman, for example, create like a sense of shared values that allow a nation to imagine itself as one people and to imagine themselves as a community of shared fate. You know, we're all in this together. And create a kind of economic territory, the size and scale of that nation's territory. So clearly, you know, we can think about print money as a form of print media. Then, as we look into, at least in the U.S., like which, the expanding size of the nation as we pushed westward, there was an increasing need for money to move not just locally hand to hand, but also move across the country, you know, to have an economy that was the scale of the nation. And so a lot of people don't realize this, but some of today's leading financial service companies like American Express, Wells Fargo, et cetera, started off as postal companies. You know, American Express was literally an express shipper, like Federal Express, moving money in the form of banknotes, but also like bullion and gold, and also the mail, moving the mail across the country. So in that sense, those financial services firms were started off as mail firms, which is a form of communication, a form of moving media. And studying the history of the mail and the history of postal history is very much part of media studies. And then as we get into the, you know, the middle of the 20th century, people like D. Hawk, who I mentioned, the kind of founder of Visa, began to imagine electronic ways of moving money around. And the very same tools and technologies that were used to build the early internet beginning in the 70s and 80s were the same tools, the same technologies used to build the Visa MasterCard network to establish electronic payment. So I'm barely old enough, but I am old enough to remember when you went to a mom pop store and wanted to use a credit card, or my mom wanted to use a credit card, and they would have to hang up the phone. They couldn't be talking on the phone at the same time as they use the POS system, because it was a modem running over the phone lines, just as the modems in our houses do, or did. And then now, as we're moving into this brave new world of social media, of mobile communication, so too are the technologies of money kind of moving into that space. And we're seeing the emergence of a variety of digital money forms that range from Bitcoin to something more mundane like PayPal and Venmo. So what I do in my work is I really study money. I put on a media studies lens and I look at money from that perspective, and I study the history and then try to really take that history and try to use it to understand the future and understand what's coming next and try to figure out what we should be concerned about, what we should be excited about, and what we should be paying attention to.
Again, our guest today is Professor Lana Swartz from UVA's Department of Media Studies, as we talk about money and everything that goes with it, the tales it tells, the media that goes with it. Professor, you talk about the media and the what the money tells you. This takes me back to a not so old conversation just in the last 2 to 3 years about the representation on the U.S. bills. If I'm not mistaken, the recent presidential administration, the Trump administration, there was conversation about putting throughout the United States about putting a female on a bill. And in the end, I believe, was it Harriet Tubman who was going to be, who was asked to represent the 10 or the 20 and have Alexander Hamilton or Andrew Jackson removed? And President Trump effectively said, I'm not doing that. Mm-hmm. So what is the representation that is going on by removing someone who has been on a bill for, I don't know, you'd have to tell me, 100 years, mm-hmm. and putting on someone from our history, changing the representation on that bill?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a really interesting story, I think. And one thing that people don't realize is that dollar bill or the design of U.S. bills changes all the time. I mean, in my lifetime, we've had relatively subtle changes that basically look like, the portrait gets moved over a little bit, it gets bigger, but they're constantly being redesigned to evade various forms of counterfeiting. And the dollar bills that we have today are actually technological marvels. They are filled with all different kinds of anti-counterfeiting technologies that we don't even notice and we don't even see. And so as I understand the story, around the time during the second Obama administration, the bills came up for redesign. And there was this idea that perhaps they could be redesigned in order to, as the administration kind of framed it, better reflect the nation's population. You know, we could have women, we could have people of color, we could tell different kinds of stories about what our history was and what our future together could be through the bill. And you know, it is interesting that I believe that Hamilton was in the earliest versions of there have been many different people on the $20 bill over the course of its history. So there was initially no people on it. It was images of the goddess of liberty. And then other ones, other versions had like the Battle of Lexington on it. And even, Pocahontas's marriage to John Rolfe, like just many different iterations. And it wasn't until, the 20th century, I believe, that that we kind of got the bill as we understand it today, with Jackson on the 20. It wasn't until the 20th century that he got on there. But pretty much since the 1920s, the design of the bills haven't changed that much. They've just kind of moved around, tried to evade copyright or counterfeiting and that sort of thing. But during the Obama administration, there was this push to say, okay, yes, let's tell different stories. Let's have a variety of different figures. And one of the people that came up, so there was this idea that we should have a woman on the bill, we were going to design, redesign all the different bills with different. There was no reason not to kind of like just because it had been basically the same since like the 1920s doesn't mean it necessarily always had to be the same way going forward. So they had a few different attempts to kind of brainstorm and figure out like who they would put on the 20 if they were to redesign it. And Tubman did emerge. I think Rosa Parks, I think Eleanor Roosevelt, I believe William Mankiller, who was the first female chief of the Cherokee Nation. These were all like leading contenders. So, and actually the initial bill that they were, that, so they were, they initially they were deciding, they were actually planning on putting a woman's face on the 10 instead of on the 20. But there, and this is so funny to me, but I've actually heard people from the Treasury say, like not high level people, just kind of low level staffers say that the extreme popularity of the musical Hamilton had some influence in redesigning the 20 before the 10, because Hamilton is so popular, they didn't want to think about replacing him. And of course, you know, Jackson does have a mixed record historically. He was a leading figure in the Native American genocide. He, you know, was a populist and is, at least if we look at who's, you know, the selection of portraits that are in the Oval Office, he's a favorite of President Trump's. But, you know, in general, he's not someone that people concerned about, you know, Native American rights and that sort of thing were, you know, he's not that a popular figure. So, you know, there were initial plans to redesign the 20 with Tubman's face on it, and during the Obama administration. And then when Trump was elected, his various staffers sort of essentially said that it was no longer a priority to redesign those bills, and that the whole project of redesigning the bills, including to have, you know, new kinds of anti-counterfeiting measures and updated technology in the bills themselves, was kind of just shelved. And, you know, there, most of what we get from the, you know, the inside take, on this issue is from, you know, some of the disgruntled former Trump staffers who have left the organization and then, like, you know, left the administration and then, you know, wrote their books to try to cash in on their experience. And one of them, Omarosa Manigault, who was a reality show figure on Trump's reality show, she said that Trump balked at the idea of putting Tubman's face on the bill and, like, sort of implied that he found her to be, you know, not attractive, or, you know, I think the quote was, "You want me to put that face on the 20. And so, you know, a lot of Trump fans were pleased with that. And they agreed that there was no real need to redesign the bill. And they saw this as rewriting history. Others who are, you know, not supporters, saw it as a attempt not so much to rewrite history, but to tell different histories. And one of the first measures that the Biden administration announced in 2021 was that they would indeed be going back to and accelerate the Tubman redesign. And that would include a picture of Tubman, and it would include all of the updated security measures, which will eventually be applied to all of the bills. An interesting story for me about this, or an interesting take for me, is how will we depict Tubman? So there is a prototype that gets passed around that depicts Tubman, and as, you know, in a similar portrait style as the other, as the existing figures on the bills tend to have, where she's like in a three-quarter profile and looks very serious. But an interesting thing about Tubman is that she was really an outdoorsman. And there are many, you know, she led many missions across the continent to part of the Underground Railroad. And we could really show an action hero version of her on the bill if we wanted to.
Our guest today is Professor Lana Swartz from UVA's Department of Media Studies, as we talk about money and the tales that it tells. In fact, when we come back from our break, I want to talk with Professor Swartz about what do various forms of payment tell about you if you use cash or your debit card versus your Amex Sapphire or Platinum. So hang tight. We'll be right back. Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. And thanks for hanging out with us today. Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Professor Lana Swartz, UVA's Department of Media Studies, telling us all about different types of money, how they came about, and the tales that they tell. In fact, that's what I want to get into next, Professor. Part of your book, I believe, in the new money and how payment became social media. There's a section on transactional identities telling me that how I make payment tells a lot about me or the individual. So can you talk about that for a bit?
Yeah. So, I mean, the story I open with in that chapter is the story of the Chase Sapphire Reserve card, which came out a couple of years ago. And it was considered at the time the latest and greatest in what the card industry thinks of as or calls the kind of premium card segment. Right. So you have to have a pretty good credit score, although just, you know, in reality, it's actually just slightly above average, quote unquote, credit score. You have to make a certain amount of money a year and have in order to qualify. But if you do qualify, you get a card that is made out of thick, heavy duty blue plastic. And in fact, this card proved to be so popular that they actually ran out of the materials they were using to make this to make it. And so, you know, people got a temporary card until they could get more of the extra thick, extra shiny, actually it's matte, blue plastic. And you have to pay $500 a year for this card. And in return, you get a free or, you know, reimbursed for TSA PreCheck or Global One preclearance. You get rewards in the form of frequent flyer miles, in the form of cashback and various other perks. And you get access to all kinds of, you know, premium perks like lounges, first class lounges at airports, or you know, the ability to buy Broadway tickets through an exclusive platform. So when this card came out, there was it really went, you know, viral, as they say. There were tons of news articles written about it. Someone I interviewed actually said that their mom read about it in the New York Times and kept texting them about it and was like, why don't you have this card? Why don't you have this card? And it was like a trendy fad card. Influencers on Instagram were making posts about it. I mean, it sounds ridiculous. But the folks over at American Express, which for the longest time, American Express had been considered, you know, especially with their American Express Black card, that had been considered the most desirable credit card, the card that could show that, you know, you're rich and you have, you know, premium access to everything. And they were actually kind of worried. And the quote from American Express executive said that an American Express Black card says you're rich, but a Chase Sapphire Reserve card says you're interesting. And so for a lot of people who felt like they wanted to show that they're interesting through their card, just felt like they had to get it. And, you know, it sounds pretty absurd and it sounds pretty ridiculous. But when you actually start asking around and talking to people, you'll realize that at least before the pandemic, this whole idea of frequent flyer miles and like getting rewards points was a major factor that went into letting, you know, and how people decided what card to use, when to use that card. And there are whole online communities for, you know, so-called like churners and points hackers who are really trying to maximize the value that they're getting out of their card. And there's a huge industry. I mean, the payments industry is making a lot of money off of these cards. On the other end, though, you know, most people aren't in this kind of elite strata where they're, you know, trying to make as much money as they can every time they pump gas. And many people, on the other hand, who have very low credit scores or who don't have a bank account, which is, you know, if statistically more than half of the United States is unbanked or underbanked, they are not getting points every time they swipe their card. And instead, they're being charged very high fees every time they swipe their card. So, you know, most people who are unbanked and underbanked use mostly cash, but you can't use cash on the internet. And there's increasing numbers of of physical locations, like where you even a few restaurants here in Charlottesville where you can't use cash. And especially during the pandemic, you know, people have like moved away from cash and are doing online pre-orders for and curbside pickup. So in order to participate in any of that, you have to get a prepaid card. And those prepaid cards have very high fees that can be as high as, you know, $25 a month just to keep the card, to maintain the card, $5 every time you refill the card, $1 every time you swipe the card. So as with many things, it's, you know, if you're wealthy, let's put it this way, it's more expensive to be poor than it is to be rich. And then in the middle, there's a lot of us who use debit cards, who use kind of more boring, as they say, rewards cards, like the Costco.
Yes, I want to know. I want to know what it tells the public. What does it tell the public? What does it tell the economics industry, the banking, or whoever sees my debit card as I flash it across my checking card? Because isn't that the proper name? What does it tell them when I pull that out to pay for my groceries or my pickup restaurant food, mm-hmm. or whatever?
Well, I think it really depends who's looking. So, you know, for the most part, I don't know if anyone here in Charlottesville and Albemarle County are really judging each other on the credit cards that they use. But definitely, you know, among certain, you know, young professionals, the first person to get the Chase Sapphire card was kind of looked on with some amount of awe. But I will say that there are some actual protections that come along with credit cards, premium or otherwise. So one thing that I think it might be important for listeners to realize is that there are better fraud protection mechanisms if you pay with a credit card rather than a debit or check card. If someone steals your card, if someone writes down your credit card number, or if someone double swipes your card when you go to check out and then pockets the money or that sort of thing, you have better recourse and better protection from your credit card company than you do from your debit card company. So I do like to advise, I mean, I don't give financial advice or anything, but I do like to tell, you know, advise people that if they can, if they don't, you know, no one wants to carry a high balance, no one wants to pay interest, but if you do pay off your credit cards every month, it can offer you some fraud protection to pay with your credit card rather than a debit or check card, especially online.
You know, that's a question. Again, our guest today, Professor mm-hmm. Lana Swartz from University of Virginia, as we talk about types of money and social media and everything that goes with that. When did things change? We talk about credit cards as though, I mean, that's just what they're called. But at some point in time, they changed from something called a charge card, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like the first, so really the history of credit cards starts with the, what are called charge-a-plates. These are little metal, they almost look like dog tags, that were used mostly by department stores. So like the old school big department stores, to allow regular customers to be able to put things on the tab and just like be sent a bill. So like all your information would be on your charge-a-plate. The department store would imprint the metal raised numbers from your charge-a-plate, and then they would use that to send you a bill later. And early gas companies, like we're talking about the 1920s, when cars first came out, also used charge-a-plates. But these charge accounts were only with one merchant. So you would have a charge at this one gas station, or you'd have a charge account at one department store. And it wasn't until the 1950s that Diners Club emerged as the first universal third-party payment card. And so it allowed you to effectively have a charge account anywhere the Diners Club card was accepted. So in the 1950s, you know, the highway system was being built. jet travel was something ordinary people started to do. Corporations started to be national scale. And so business trips started to be more common. You know, the coolest new innovations in the 50s in some ways were the motel, the rental car, having advanced teletype reservation systems. So but the U.S. banking system was largely decentralized, meaning the first Bank of Charlottesville would be literally the Bank of Charlottesville. It wasn't like, and you know, you may remember in the 80s and 90s, a lot of those banks were consolidated and all got bought up and became Bank of America or Wells Fargo or that sort of thing. But there used to be much more regulated banks that made it so you couldn't have branches in multiple states. So it was actually really hard for people to travel on the new highways and drive their rental cars and take plane trips, business trips, because they were moving much faster and further than their money could. There was no ATM on every corner that you could get money out. You couldn't go to the local branch of your bank and take money out because there was no local branch. And actually, you know, people definitely use checks, but many merchants were leery about accepting out-of-town checks from banks they didn't recognize because it was a leap of faith to expect that that check would clear. And by the time you found out that the check had bounced, the person who wrote the check was long gone. So there was a lot of coverage in the press in the 50s that, you know, the person who needs access to money most, the traveler, was the person who was most out of luck. So Diners Club emerged in the 50s and really took off speed and in the 60s to create what was called, you know, the category of travel and leisure cards or charge cards, where they got many, many merchants, mostly in the travel sector, so hotels, restaurants, that sort of thing, to accept their cards. And then the cardholder would present their card and be able to pay for things at point of purchase. And then the merchant, the hotel, would send the bill to Diners Club. Then Diners Club would consolidate all the bills, you know, all your receipts from that month, that spending period, and mail it to you. And you'd have to pay the whole thing in full right away. So it wasn't really a credit card in the sense that you have a, you know, $5,000 line of credit and you can hold it every month and you just have to pay interest on it. Instead, it was more like a system of deferred billing or what is often called country club style billing, where you can put it on the tab and you're trusted to pay it off. But that network of where you can put it on the tab is anywhere the Diners Club is accepted instead of just your local club or your local department store. So then, you know, but really that just applied to, you know, the business traveler, to the professional class. And so in the 70s, what happened was the trying to figure out how to make credit cards available for, you know, more ordinary people. And with that came banks that tied that card to a line of credit and sought to make money by charging high rates of interest. So, you know, the early debit cards didn't have interest, were in fact not credit cards, and it wasn't until later that cards became associated with going into debt.
Again, our guest today is Professor Lana Swartz as we talk about different types of money and the social media that goes with them. Professor, we've only mentioned some of the, I want to say digital money, some of the new versions of money. There's Venmo, there's PayPal. You mentioned something that I'm completely oblivious to until I start reading your book, Facebook's Libra. Mm-hmm. Talk about that, because there's also Bitcoin, and I'm reading this and I'm like, how is that different from Bitcoin? What's going on mm-hmm. here?
Yeah. So, you know, in really beginning of the 90s, but definitely into the 2000s and today, you know, suddenly more and more people were going online and living more of their lives online and communicating online. And just in the same way that kind of the geography and the scale of who we communicate with, but also who we need to pay, got shaken up in the 50s. But the emergence of the highways and more extensive travel, so too did the geography of our communicative worlds get really shaken up through the internet. So, you know, one of the most interesting innovations that came out of the internet in the earlier days in the 90s was eBay. And, you know, it's actually really cool to be able to sell something you don't want to someone who wants it on the other side of the country. But the challenge there is, okay, you can sell it to them, you can mail them the goods, but how are you going to pay them? How are you going to receive payments from them? And it really wasn't until PayPal kind of figured out a system for using the existing check network and using the existing ACH, automated clearinghouse network, to allow person-to-person payments, that online economies, you know, really, really took off. And so since then, we've seen a lot of different innovations in this space. And, you know, today, our communication happens instantaneously anywhere in the world, but our money is still not really able to move at the same speed and scale reliably all the time. So there have long been different visions for trying to figure out how to make money that moves quickly in a globalized communication world. One vision of that is Bitcoin, which has, you know, started off as this, you know, with kind of two different visions. One is a form of digital cash, so like a payment system that was meant to be independent of traditional banks, independent of traditional governments, free from surveillance. So, you know, you could just pay someone freely. And then another vision of it was as a form of digital gold. So a speculative investment that would rise in value, and you could buy it and keep it, hold it as a commodity, and then maybe potentially get rich by selling it at a much higher rate. And as we know, there have been some people who have made a lot of money off of Bitcoin. But I argue that all of the speculative interest in Bitcoin has undermined its ability to serve as a payment system. And some people argue that's a good thing because anonymous payments can fuel all kinds of illicit economies. But others argue that it's maybe somewhat disappointing because they really had a vision for creating payments that were fast and easy. So you mentioned Libra. So in recent years, Facebook kind of looked at Bitcoin and said, we can use some of that technology and we can use that to produce a payment system that will work instantly the whole world over among anyone who uses Facebook. And actually, I have to say, like, you know, we'll see what happens, but the whole vision of a blockchain-based payment system inside of Facebook kind of died a spectacular death. And it hasn't really been as much of a disruptive innovation as Facebook thought it would be. And as far as I know, Facebook isn't really pursuing that vision anymore.
Our guest today is Professor Lana Swartz, UVA's Department of Media Studies, just teaching us so many things about money and everything that's attached to it besides the sound of coins and a few dirty fingers on some dollar bills. So hang tight. Let's come back for the last part of the show. And Sunday morning wake up call, back in your lap on Sunday morning, talking about money, something you have around you in all sorts of ways, bills, coins, cards, computers. You may not even thought about it all, but Professor Lana Swartz here to keep talking about it. Professor, we were talking about Libra on Facebook. When did it come about? And finish up that conversation.
Yeah. So, I believe the last years wiped my brain, but beginning in 2019, 2020-ish, there was the planned launch of Libra in 2020, and we began hearing rumblings about it in the year or so before, Facebook announced that it was going to launch its own cryptocurrency. And Facebook argued that this was going to allow it to have money that moved at the same speed as a Facebook direct message, right? And that you'd be able to pay anyone anywhere in the world. And this seemed to, you know, and right now, like the cross-border payments, the remittance payments, so people, you know, working in one country and sending money to their family in another country, is pretty big business, but it's a pretty kludgy, clunky system and doesn't work very well. And so Facebook kind of promised to disrupt all of that and maybe also disrupt the way we all pay each other. Like, so instead of paying a dog sitter with cash or with Venmo, you would pay them on Facebook. We're all on Facebook, so why not use it as a universal address book for payments? But of course, you know, especially in the last couple of years, Facebook has not been a terribly popular company. So, you know, they're seen as primarily getting most of their revenue from surveilling us and advertising to us and targeting us. And that's something, you know, even if we use Facebook all the time, we may not be all that comfortable with. And so do we really want them to have access to this whole other data set, which is everything we pay for and who we pay? And, you know, they haven't necessarily shown themselves to be very good stewards of community. So, you know, not great at moderating and figuring out, you know, when to, what kinds of conversations should be on the site, what kinds of conversations shouldn't be on the site. And so maybe many people felt they shouldn't be, you know, the place where we do something as important as our money. And then, you know, and then even, you know, lawmakers and regulators were like, wait a minute, Facebook has a lot of power over a lot of different domains. And they're, you know, always trying to move into new realms. Do we really want them doing money? So there was popular backlash of, you know, just the average person just being uncomfortable with the idea. There was regulatory and governmental backlash, and Mark Zuckerberg was, you know, asked to come and, you know, testify about Libra. And then even inside the actual payments community, in the payments industry, there was some idea that maybe the plans for Libra weren't as fleshed out as they could have been. So they made big promises, but it wasn't clear exactly on how they were going to deliver on it. So then a variety of different partners from, you know, from inside the financial services industry began to pull out of Libra, and it seemed like Libra was more or less dead in the water. However, the idea of doing payments on Facebook has not gone away. And in a much less kind of like splashy, much less like promising to change the world effort, Facebook did quietly launch what they call Facebook Pay, which is a payment system inside of Facebook where you can pay people for things. And it hasn't made too much of a splash, but, you know, we'll see where it goes. And I could really see something like Facebook Libra or some iteration thereof taking hold in the developing world, in places where the local currencies are not very stable, in places where there is a lot of remittance payment from, you know, centers where people are working to places where their families are receiving money. And I could see it finding a rebirth in that domain, and also where, you know, the government regulators are not as strong and are not as able to stand up to the likes of Facebook, and then maybe eventually making its way back to the US and after kind of being incubated in the developing world. But that's definitely something to keep an eye on and something I will be keeping my eyes on.
So Professor, during as you talked about Libra there, you mentioned people possibly using, or at least Facebook saying, you could use Libra instead of Venmo. So tell us about Venmo, because my wife has Venmo. I do not. That's by choice. But to me, as I'm reading about Venmo and learning even more, I'm like, Venmo, what? I only see the good sides of that, and just by choice don't have it. But look at all the potential questionable negative parts for all of us older folks.
So it's so funny. There are, I would say, my undergrad students, without exception, every single one of them has Venmo, uses Venmo every day. And almost everyone I talk to over a certain age, I'm not going to suggest what that age is or say anything about your age, but almost everyone over a certain age has no idea what it even is. Hasn't even
over
heard
25.
Of it. Yes,
over 25. I'm no longer an undergrad student.
Right. So let's just say anyone who's not a millennial or under may be less familiar with Venmo. So what Venmo is a person-to-person payments app that's owned by PayPal. It was acquired by PayPal a number of years ago. And it is essentially a social feed of payments. So I can pay you, you know, let's say you... you know, we went to the farmer's market and I was out of cash and you lent me a couple bucks to buy a coffee or an eggplant. and then I would just pay you with Venmo the $5 that I owe you. Sure, you know, easy enough from my account to your account. But what Venmo did is that they added a social feed to it. So instead of that just being a private payment between the two of us, I could set my privacy settings to either be public to just our friends. So anyone who's friends with both of us will see that I paid you $5 and I can actually doesn't list the price amount, but that I paid you and then whatever caption I put on with it. So maybe I would say, I pay you. And I say, thank you so much for lending me $5 at the farmer's market, or put on some emojis or put on a GIF, and all of our friends could see that I paid you for something. Or I could set my privacy settings to fully public, to global, and then anyone in the world can see just by looking at this public feed in the same way Twitter functions as a public feed that I paid you that amount. And many times, and I think even people in the payments industry are a little bit mystified about why on earth anyone would want to do this. But let me tell you, it has been the killer app. It has been the thing that made mobile payments, person-to-person payments happen in the United States, because young people enjoy that social element. And as a scholar of, you know, communication, as a scholar of social media, I can really relate to that. Like, money is fundamentally social. When we pay friends, it removes some of the awkwardness, it adds some playfulness to be able to add some of this sociality to it. And this, of course, is, you know, many people have grown up in a, you know, nowadays, millennials and under have grown up in an environment where a lot of things are public and we're used to kind of performing for our friend audiences. But, you know, there is, I have to say, I never set my Venmo transactions as anything but private. I don't want anyone seeing who I pay. I have nothing to hide, but at the same time, I'm not performing for anyone. And I do think there are some dangers that could be associated with having a public feed of payments.
You tell this story in the book, again, New Money, How Payment Became Social Media, by Professor Lana Swartz. You tell some tale about, and again, I think this is an imaginary tale, about how Rick broke up with Susan, and then I think you tell it from the female point of view. Susan sees that Rick has received or made payment to Claire, and who Susan also knows. And so she figures out that Claire and Rick might be dating and et cetera. And I was just like, my mind exploded. We had to clean up the mess.
One of the pleasures of Venmo is that it allows you to really get the real scoop on what's going on in someone's life. Like, you know, we all are posturing for our Facebook followers and our Instagram followers, but you know, the real story is in who we're paying. And so I definitely have interviewed and talked to many students who absolutely use Venmo to kind of spy on their exes, spy on their future prospects, someone they're interested in, spy on their friends, find out if their friends are hanging out without them. And it's seen as like more authentic, than the more curated, activity that happens on Instagram or on Facebook. But at the same time, people have begun to, you know, catch on to that. And they are indeed kind of, making themselves look more interesting on Venmo than they actually are. So, you know, I've interviewed people who have young people who talk about paying their roommate for rent, but instead of putting a boring caption that says rent, they might put some margarita glasses to make it look like it's for something more exciting.
And so you paid $650 for margaritas.
Well, yeah. So you don't actually see the amount, no. But yes, exactly. Or I've heard other horror stories of, say, you go on a date, you know, let's just say a young man and a young woman go on a date. The young man pays. Let's say the date doesn't go very well. And the two individuals, you know, wake up the next morning, you know, in their own beds, not having, you know, continued the date. And then the man who paid is like, well, you know what? I'm never going to see that girl again. And I don't know why I spent $100 on dinner. And he'll actually Venmo request her for $50, say, pay up for your half of the dinner. And ooh. I absolutely have heard that. And multiple times. It's a, you know, real horror story. On the other hand, I've heard of people, you know, knowing that their best friend or, you know, someone they haven't kept in touch with for a while is going to a job interview or has a big day. So they'll send them $3.65 with the note to say, you know, because that's exactly how much the latte that they always, that they love to get costs. And they'll say, buy yourself a latte. So it can be a way of really, you know, troubling antisocial behavior, but it can also be a way for people to kind of show that they care in interesting ways. So, you know, they talk about penny pokes where you just kind of send your friend one penny. And that is just an indication that says, I'm thinking of you or that sort of thing. So it's a site of a lot of new norms, new manners. You know, people talk about how it's bad manners to round down instead of rounding up on Venmo. I mean, it's a whole new world. But I do think this idea of like who is actually watching, it's one thing if your friends are watching, but it's another thing if, you know, all that data that's available in the public API, all that data that Venmo is collecting, you know, they're like any other social media company, they're ultimately in the business of using that, of monetizing that data. So do you want your health insurance company, say, to know that you bought pizza every single day for lunch? Do you want your, you know, there are many different ways that your information can be tracked about you, and that information can be presented to audiences that you may not have anticipated. Your friends, your exes, your parents, you know, those might be audiences you're immediately concerned about. But what about all the hidden audiences that are monetizing that data and are ready to monetize that data, whether you set it as private or not?
Professor Lana Swartz here with us as we talk about money and everything that is attached to that. Professor, we're down to just about 4 minutes left in the program. So you were talking about privacy, and obviously in that last little bit, you were talking about the privacy, even though you may have Venmo set on private, it doesn't stop the folks in the background from pilfering that and possibly sharing that. But how does the digital world in general keep things safe and secure? You also mentioned earlier in the hour about other countries. How do you get the data to other countries? How do you make sure that security in other countries where your information may be traveling in some manner, whether direct or indirect, is secure?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we all have to be, you know, careful about how we do money online. I think, you know, being really cognizant of using, you know, of what your consumer protections are. So as I mentioned, you know, you absolutely have better protection if you use a credit card, because your credit card company is more likely to shoulder a greater liability of fraud than your debit card is. But I also want to point out, like, a lot of times when new technologies come about, people are fearful of them. And I like to recall that some of the older money technologies are some of the least secure when it comes to theft and fraud. So if someone steals a dollar bill from you, it's gone. Right? There's no way you can get it back. It is what it is. You know, cash, I think cash is a great technology because it's anti-surveillance. It doesn't require, you know, the telephones or the electrical grid or anything to use. It just works all the time. But when it's gone, it's gone. Similarly, a credit card is kind of seen as the next step of evolution in this technology, but it is quite insecure as well. If you all you need to quote unquote hack a credit card are those numbers. You know, I could spend 1 minute with your credit card or less and be able to use it without your discretion. So while it's definitely easy to imagine that we're moving into the Wild West, that the internet is a dangerous place full of theft and fraud, which it can be, we have to also remember that all money technologies have their strengths and weaknesses, and that we have to like remain cognizant and be, you know, just kind of well educated about what we're using when we pay.
Professor, we've got a little less than a minute. Can you tell me why didn't we ever go to global cash and coins?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. That's more than a minute. But I would say, you know, money, you know, it's really the strength of the government institutions that issue that money. So, you know, our dollars are worth a lot more than, you know, the Mexican pesos, for example. And so it is pretty, it would be pretty difficult to create a money system that met the economic needs of all countries in the world. I will say, though, that there are certain countries like Ecuador that are actually pegged to the US dollar, and US dollars and Ecuadorian minted currency just circulate alongside each other. And because, you know, they have a you know, lower cost economy, they're still kind of a developing economy, things are less expensive. So they use a lot more coins. And believe it or not, almost all of our Sacagawea dollar coins have all pooled in Ecuador. There's more Sacagawea US $1 coins circulating in Ecuador than there is in the United States. And as my friend, who's an anthropologist, who says Ecuador, tells me, the Ecuadorians have actually like adopted that image of Sacagawea. They see her as one of them, as an Andean woman, indigenous woman, and she's become something of a national icon in Ecuador, whereas we hardly ever see her at all.
Interesting. Professor Lana Swartz, UVA's Department of Media Studies. Professor, I hope you'll return in the future. I had all kinds of stuff. We didn't get to talk about politics with issues such as businesses that refuse to work with with President Trump or any of his businesses, the risk of marijuana sales and federal banks. I mean, there's just so much more to discuss. I hope you'll come back one day in the future.
Oh, thank you. I'd love to.
All right. So Sunday morning wake-up call finishes up another hour, and let's get back to the real oldies on 97.9 The Wren.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake-Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.